Good. Let's move on to part two then. So with Katia Sanchibanez, we now have, in a way, for the first time this evening, an artist giving us an unmediated product of her hand. And this, I think, in a way, shifts the register from part one to part two of the pairings of shows that we are examining this evening. And I think some very interesting contrasts between these two shows will emerge. We'll nonetheless hopefully try to give a little time to each show and then perhaps spare, if we do so briskly, perhaps there will be some time to really get some comparison between them. But Karen, Katia Sanchibanez, very obsessive, perhaps, very structured, very rhythmic, and some would say algorithmic approach.
Yes.
How much was for you there a pleasure in the result, or how much was there a fascination with the process, or was there no pleasure or fascination?
There was some pleasure and fascination, but not as much as I would have maybe would have hoped it for. My immediate thought, especially when I saw the pencil on the column that was in progress, and she came back daily to work on it a little bit, was Saul LeWitt, right? So there's, you know, the drawings in situ, this algorithmic, very obsessive, repetitive feel to it. It's very different from Saul LeWitt, however, insofar as these are sort of done freehand. There's not actually, from what I understand, a precise rule that is being followed. She's doing it sort of just so that the patterns, what I found interesting was that the patterns aren't actually patterns insofar as there isn't an actual repeat. They just look as if they are a precise pattern. And there's a couple of them that I actually found really beautiful, especially because there's one in particular that we saw an image of that it looks much more beautiful in person, that is these sort of fern-like or sort of little floral sort of shapes that are repeated, and it looks almost like a textile. And then you realize that you know it's irregular, but it just gives the illusion of regularity. I started thinking of Kant because I'm a philosopher. I have to. And so in the Critique of Judgment, that sort of foundational work in aesthetics, he says that wallpaper, that he mentions wallpaper in his list of things that cause us to respond with great pleasure, because of the sort of scrolling foliage that is sort of gives us it looks like there's a pattern or something purposive happening, but we can't quite put our finger on what's going on. And I thought, yes, okay, now I that's working for me. Some of them just so seemed so fiddly and obsessive, especially the pencil ones. I was left sort of struggling to kind of enjoy them.
David, this degree of fiddly obsession, fuss and fiddle, it can't simply be a byproduct or an incidental. It's presumably crucial to the aesthetic, do you think? Labor intensity. Is there an aesthetics of labor intensity at play in Sanchibanez?
There might be a morality of labor intensity. Mm-hmm. I've known her work for something like 15 years, and when I first saw it, she was painting these very rigorous, disciplined, small monochromatic paintings of things like knots in wood or pine cones. And, you know, they were not ingratiating in the least, but they were definitely serious. And then she had this breakthrough sometime in the 90s where she began to think abstractly about how to structure the space of a painting and make internal divisions within it, but preserving some of the natural motifs from her work with direct observation, but abstracted. The painting, I think it's called Hidden Version or something that you were talking about, Karen, that you liked, is you know, the motif that repeats in somewhat unpredictable ways in that painting is kind of like a fan palm shape. And depending on how it's mirrored across the seams, it's either in phase or out of phase. If it's in phase, then it looks like sort of sound waves. When it's out of phase, it begins to actually create its illusion of a spiral. And there's also a lot of room around these incidents for the eye to sort of absorb all of these variations and to enjoy them. All of the rest of the paintings in the show are of a very different nature, and it's more like what she was originally doing with the obsessive paintings of the knots, in that they're, you know, she sets herself a task and she fulfills it, and there is very beautiful variations of the hand within, but they're somewhat overwhelmed by the impressive structure. It's a grid structure, but it's not the least bit meditative. It's almost like it feels very. I may be projecting here, but especially the black and the black and the white painting, it feels very Catholic to me. And she is French and she's Spanish, and she has this earnestness about what she does that reminds me of the sort of the abandon of the sort of a romantic abandon to a cause of the French and the religious zeal of the Spanish. And it really feels that black and white painting, for all of its incredible visual stimulation, it's airless, because where there, you know, it alternates black on black figure on white on red ground, and then red figure on black ground, and there's something like 200 or more cells that do this. So you have to breathe. You have to breathe solidness. You don't ever get air to breathe in that painting. So it just seems to me that in this show, Katya has gone back to this to a different kind of. Idea about painting. I think maybe a transitional show. The work that she had done previously the usual motif was grass-like blades, and there was delectable color, and there was air, and there was movement. There was also all kinds of more wider suggestion of sexuality. Sometimes they read like pubic hair or wounds or fire. They could also read like graphic novels, the kind of jaggy shading that creates these very rounded forms. So they were sexy. And I'm sure if anyone here read the Brooklyn Rail Review, the one thing you remember is how she talks about having just have sex every day and not just 10 minutes. So this is her the way that she presents herself.
More French than Catholic, perhaps.
Yeah. Perhaps in that case.
Okay.
Anyway, I'll leave.
Yeah.
No.
That's.
That element is somewhat missing in the show for me.
Okay. Right. So, Ara, wallpaper and not enough sex is the ball that you have been passed here.
It's interesting that you mention wallpaper. I mean, because of their relentless symmetry, they risk the wallpaper, right? I mean, unlike
court-light wallpaper, let's just say, you know, wallpaper isn't necessarily bad.
And well, also, it also puts me in mind of Ruskin, similar to Kant, the finding the figure in the, he wasn't allowed to look at art, or he wasn't allowed to play with toys, so as a kid he looked at the threads in the carpet and played little games with that. So there's something of
well,
that.
Well, I mean, leaving Kant aside for a second, I mean, the title of the show is inspired by Rousseau, right? So what more sort of natural philosopher could we have, in a certain sense, of kind of this idea of the solitary wanderer finding in nature the sort of the self. And for me, the works are sort of Agnes Martin meets Vija Selmin's On a Safari.
Some tribalness.
There's some tribalness. The column was sort of Saul LeWitt goes on safari, which, you know, as David introduced, I mean, this is all about craft, right? I mean, if you're left cold by installation and conceptual art, if you don't want to run to the wall text the second you get in the gallery, you want to actually look at the work, this is the show for you, right? I mean, she has crafted these things, she has wrought them, and there are points in the drawings which the drawings are actually all in graphite, in which what looks like a repetitive symmetrical pattern is in fact reversed and alternated. I mean, she's really she has thought about the way these things are laid down on the paper. I thought it was also Very telling and interesting that this work, The Other Side, which is one of the few deeply brightly colored works in the show, looks like it's a lithograph. I mean, it's framed as if it were a print, but is in fact a drawing of ink. So there's a real kind of carefulness. And they, perhaps of all the works that we've seen, they reproduce the worst because they are so subtle in terms of their material. The Red Path, which is made with evident flash, which is evidently a kind of matte acrylic-based material. Some of the nuances of these works are very much lost in reproduction.
Sure.
And totally. I will say that that around the corner in the same gallery are four paintings by Dean Monogenes, which I must admit held my attention for far longer and with much greater interest. I think they're wonderful paintings. There's these very brightly painted acrylics on wood panel of what look like sort of California modernist architecture. As one of the gallery assistants brilliantly put it, it's sort of California modern meets X-Files. They're wonderful, those are four small paintings, and they really repay looking. So if you didn't get a chance to see them, you should. Not to take away from Katya's.
No, I felt that actually those two shows helped each other. I mean, the Dean show sent us back to look for a more sci-fi kind of narrative in the sheer nuttiness and obsessiveness of Katya. But I think that there's maybe some contemplative oceanic quality in Katya, which is a contradiction to what David's saying. But not one that I'm going to forcefully argue. I mean, I think you're right that this show is less. Less for the eye to sink into and more troubled.
I was trying to point out that there's a range in her work generally, but it's not so much on display in this show. And there are a couple of drawings, I think, that are maybe my favorite pieces in the show that that play with pencil weight density and do more in terms of dividing the grid into some more quadrilaterally symmetrical kind of play that begins to move in the direction of Arabic mosaics or Persian carpets or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in contrast to the big paintings, which are just grid, period, you know, maybe a couple of stripes in the middle of them. So the way that she uses the pencil in those two drawings, and a couple of drawings, let's say, they begin to shimmer. The surface begins to shimmer almost like a Dan Walsh or something like that. You can really enjoy it. There's one drawing that uses a motif where she's really using the side of the pencil instead of filling in the shading the shape, and when she's using the pencil as a direct marking tool, she really extends the range of that, and you can move very close up to that drawing and see these each little square has these kind of fir tree motifs coming in from all angles and making this circular pattern, and then you step back and there's hundreds of them, and they form larger patterns and larger patterns, and that is very engaging stuff. And the fact that they are handmade, and she's sitting there making these drawings, is incredible.
Yeah,
I mean you can't print those out.
I would not describe her as a conceptual artist, but these are nonetheless very ludic works. They're about play and they're about setting rules for herself, which she then follows. So it's sort of an internalized conceptualism. It's not like the conceptual art that looks out to other rules and systems, but it's setting her own rules and her own systems, and channeling and sort of funneling a sort of vision through her own obsessiveness.
And I guess that's where I struggle a bit with it on principle. I mean, as the title "Journey of a Solitary Painter" indicates, this is about the result of a certain kind of experience that she has alone in her studio, making these obsessive patterned works. And so I feel that I'm being asked to witness her obsessive sort of process rather than being asked to share in an experience that the results of that process are going to give to me. And for me, this is a very crucial distinction. And I didn't always feel as though I was let in on the sort of insularity of the process and the sort of obsessive character of the work.
I just have to comment on the title because it's come up a couple of times. You know, that title would work really well as a Sean Landers show title. You know, it begs to be read ironically, but she means it quite earnestly, and it really doesn't work for me, except that she's perfectly sophisticated, knows exactly how it's going to read, and that's her choice. It's an interesting choice.
But I think Karen makes a crucial point because she does fit into a zeitgeist in which many, many artists, not to put you on the spot, but you included, create work out of a very focused, algorithmic, intense, playful kind of working within its own rules kind of intensity. But it's true that there's a certain coolness or even coldness in Katya, that it's in Sanchi-Benez, that she is doing that thing, but it creates something akin to some of the ethnographic things that have been mentioned, rather than really necessarily drawing us into a strange universe.
Well, and again, if some of those grass motif paintings were on view,
right, okay,
we would be having a different discussion.
Okay. I see them as sort of icons of an obsession rather than, what would the opposite of an icon, rather than a sort of a field of obsessiveness, if that... Does that work?
Do you see, we'll work on
don't
it.
Don't look at me.
Okay. In other words, what she does then produces something that signifies an obsessiveness rather than something that simply is obsessive.
Well, what is obsession? An obsessive is someone who can't stop working and doesn't know when a piece has ended. Her work is very clearly has a beginning, middle, and an end.
It's not the right word.
Yes. It's forceful, it's rigorous, it's disciplined, it's intense.
Intense, yes. Okay. Well, how intense, how obsessive are we with McClelland, then? Who'd like to jump in on McClelland? You've all started on a show. Ara?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, the show actually starts before you get in the gallery, interestingly enough. Some of the silk screens... which are really the most playful aspect of the show, were plastered on next to the gallery door. I didn't even realize that it was part of the show until I got up into the gallery, and they are part of, as you walk into the gallery, at least as I did, you saw propped up next to some of the works a folder that said mergers and acquisitions, and I thought to myself, well, Jesus, they're certainly not publishing their stock options for everyone to witness. And yet that title seems to resonate with these combined, fused portraits that she's rendered, which, for those of you who don't know, have overlaid essentially Google searched images of everyone including, timely enough, Silvio Berlusconi and Rupert Murdoch, Anita Bryant and Lady Gaga, Tammy Faye and Newt Gingrich, Ahmadinejad and Sarah Palin. These silk screens were on the street before you even get up to the gallery. And so these are the mergers and acquisitions that she's, the images that she's merged together. The rest of the show is, for all of its painterliness and exteriority and exuberance and, again, things that have been wrought with her hand, is also a deeply conceptual show. It looks like gestural, abstract, expressionist painting, but there is a trope, or several tropes, sort of unifying the show, which you really have to get into before you can be steeped in its meaning, a number of which include... these video stills which you saw, which look again at I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched and Wonder Woman, which are projected in the same small sort of cubby of space as Hans Nemeth's famous video of Jackson Pollock painting and Eve Klein's using women as human brushes, which are sort of distorted and projected onto a separate screen, and then her own paintings, which are in the larger gallery itself. a number of which are based on aspects of popular culture and what evidently, and I didn't even know this, was what was called the Roxanne Wars of, I believe, the 1990s, when there was a series of 80s, when there were a series of songs, rap songs put out that responded to each other. And so they were carried out on the airwaves in New York over months and months, and they were called the Roxanne Wars because these rap artists would respond to each other in songs. And so McClellan has conceived of the show in some ways as a kind of response. It's called Left, which responds to her own earlier show a couple of decades ago called Right. It's kind of a response to herself, but also to the other artists. It also has feminist themes. Maybe you
feminism and rock and roll, Karen. Now, is this the Ara has beautifully, ekphrastically described for us this plethora of strategies, options, appropriate language for the mergers and acquisitions, perhaps, but also it's maybe a little bit of one of those shows, kitchen sink and all, or is it an artist hedging her bets with different things, or is it an artist just overflowing with expressive possibilities? What do you make of the range of formats, presentations, scales?
I know I've used this adjective already, but I have to say I felt that the show was really uneven. I can't guess at her motivation for presenting all of the different kinds of things she did. I'm not quite sure how to read that. But my own response to it critically was that I thought some parts of it were much stronger and more compelling than others. Me personally, and I would be very interested to hear what others think about this, I preferred the paintings, much preferred the paintings where they're sort of intriguing and that they kind of feel like graffiti. And that you have to kind of squint, you know, that graffiti where you have to squint at the writing and to make out what word it's saying. But they're kind of beautiful formally. I found them sort of compelling. I was very disappointed by the installation, however. I felt like I was immediately at the Bennington College Senior Art Show, and there was this sort of the two projectors were covered in cardboard boxes, and the wire was covered in aluminum foil. I was just bewildered by the kind of tackiness and lack of care and craftsmanship that was put into the presentation, and I mean, there were moments where I felt like, it's like I'm in one of her paintings, and that's kind of interesting. But I was actually distracted by the kind of the poor quality of the construction of the installation, and then just mystified by the TV show montages of Wonder Woman. It's Linda Carter doing her wind-up before she spins into becoming Wonder Woman, and it's just the wind-up, though.
The wind without the wonder.
I was just very mystified.
The Left, which ties into the title Left.
It's also
responding to a Dana Birnbaum piece that was, I think, in the Pictures Generation show at the Met, in the way that the rappers respond to each other.
Oh, that's helpful.
Other.
I didn't realize that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did get this kind of, grad school thesis show feeling. Mm-hmm. But
and her student did help her, so there's
give her credit, because she was doing things like this 20 years ago, and it's not so much that the grad school kids can't, tape down a chord properly. It's that the aesthetic that McClellan, among other people, has invented has come to be adopted by certain sophisticates in art, pipeline. So, she's. I think what's happening here with all of the different strategies to distract you and to make you think about things that seem to have nothing to do with painting, to lean paintings against walls, to make fragmentary works on pieces of drywall, and even maybe especially in paintings themselves, just seen as paintings, the way that she uses goopy, resinous plastics on top of these, these, you know, the oil paint, and then sort of dusts them with this dirty surface. You know, all of these are strategies that she, or let's say obstacles that she puts in front of herself and the viewer, because, you know, her big problem is that she has an incredibly beautiful hand, and she wants to make beautiful paintings, but she wants to make beautiful paintings that are not ingratiating, that have, that are political, that have content, that are, that can be angry, and that's the kind of beauty that she's interested in. And
but like Modigliani sort of trying to draw with his foot to frustrate his own facility.
Perhaps, and yet she does allow her hand into this work ultimately, and just after I got past the smokescreen, and after I began to digest some of the conceptual issues in play, and even as I'm looking at the slideshow, the beauty of the work has grown and grown on me. There's a couple of paintings that are astonishingly beautiful. There's one called, well, maybe it's Roxanne Wars or something, but it was hung right next to the gallery office, and, and it was not well lit, almost deliberately, almost provocatively so, but it could have hung next to a Victor Hugo experiment with pouring ink and making medieval gloomy castles and giant monograms of his name floating in the sky.
Yeah,
in the same, you know, she does use words as objects, and she also makes these very beautiful spaces that you can fall into.
Yeah.
Plus the goopy part in this case. You know, really looked like a wounded limb out of an Otto Dix trench drawing.
Right.
And
I was surprised. I must confess, Karen, that your complaint about the facture, because she's painterly, she's informelle, it's loose, but it seems to me almost a fault. Almost. She's consummately skillful, and it's an aesthetic decision to be goofy and pouring out
and
of the edges.
And it didn't work. In the installation, with respect. I mean, I think the paintings are beautiful, and they're like rich, and they're lush, and yet they're gritty, and they're both, and that tension is really interesting. And then I just, you know, when I plunked down to sit in the installation, I just thought,
Do we mean specifically the video installation against and the drapery in the back room, or do you also include with installation the way that she's installed the front with those strange panels and the different hanging, different levels of hang?
I was really thinking more of the former, the little room with the curtain and the But
she definitely has a sense of humor and irony. I mean, walking into the front hall is the title of the show scrawled on a napkin.
Yes.
To the left, propped up against the wall on the floor, is a bloated object, which turns out to be the abstract expressionist issue of Art Forum, which was left out in the rain and was so puffed up and swollen by water damage that it's assumed the status of a kind of sculpture, which she subsequently painted over an abex-like gesture. So I think you're right to the extent that the show isn't sure whether or not it's a show of or about painting.
Right.
Why not just be a beautiful painter? I mean, it's almost like an apology, like, you know, some sort of apologetics of, you know, look, I'm hip, I can make art out of things.
I think the skepticism about painting goes right down to every piece of paint she puts on the canvas, and it goes all the way up to how she thinks about installing an entire show. I think it's through and through, and
you can't be an abstract expressionist painter in 2001 without being ironic, without being self-conscious, right?
Or
I mean,
apologetic?
I don't know if it's necessarily. I didn't get the sense that it was apologetic. It might be that she is self-effacing, as some of you put it, that in terms of embarrassed almost at her own facility.
Can I just correct that for a second? I don't think she's. I think she's pushing it. She's finding a way to push it.
Right. I felt that she, I respect Karen's decision that she's failed at it, but I saw her simply as, I saw her using the room in the classic installationist, a sort of positive installationist way, using the room as her canvas and seeking to do with each quote-unquote resolved painting becomes like a brushstroke within the totality of the room. And whether I was finding myself, in a funny way, breaking my own cardinal principles. I was less concerned with local details as to whether it was working and more seduced, sucked in by the ambition of her having to want to make it work. And so then I'm questioning for myself, well, why am I bending my rules? Because usually I say, I don't care what your ambition is, let's look at the results. And so in a way, it's probably because of its intrinsic anti-formalism that one sort of does not, I think, profit. The work doesn't profit by a rigorous formal analysis as to whether it's working or not. It's instead just draws you into the energy of its own ambition.
And she's smart enough to keep one step ahead of any kind of formal critique you could level at it, or conceptual critique. Hmm. And she's pushing that as well. It might be interesting to think about what would happen if she was taken on by Matthew Marx and given access to the Louvre, or you know what the equivalent would be, and access to their galleries to do an installation, and she had 15 studio assistants to do whatever she wanted. I don't know why I bring that up, but it just seems like it's very, all of the decisions, even though she's generously giving credit for collaboration with her student, all of the decisions in there are very personal. And they really can't be delegated, and that they're happening in front of you, and they're happening as she's putting leaning this thing against the wall over here and not over there.
But let's try to answer Karen's basic question. Why does she have to be so... Why can't she just let her hair down and be a good painter, as it were?
I think she's too skeptical about painting.
Right.
And deeply, in a deeply... rigorous, deep way.
Skeptical because she's a feminist who listens to lots of rock music, or a feminist, or skeptical because it's, as Ara says, you can't just be an abstract expressionist now. But I mean, funny enough, Ara, I mean, in a way, why can't we at this stage, by 2011, say you can't just be a postmodernist now? Because that's been going on, you know, that's been going on for 3 decades as opposed to being 5 decades old. Right. There must come a historical moment where it's not necessarily that much more retro to be an Abex painter than it would be to be a sort of postmodern ironist or hipster or deconstructor.
Right.
But let's, on that note, bring in the audience for a final some words on. I see that some of you are needing to go for dinner. I don't blame you. I'm quite hungry myself. But let's have some minutes of roving mic, and any comments on either of the shows we've been looking at, Katia Sánchez-Benéz or Suzanne McClelland. Or do we want to discuss it in smaller groups over a glass of wine and dinner out there in the great wide world? I don't think it's any poor reflection on Katia or Suzanne. On the contrary, it's a compliment to this evening's marvelous panelists that we have dealt with these shows and given you food for thought. Thank you very much. Have a great...
What did you think of the mashup portrait?